In this 10th episode of the Monday Christian series, Paul, Kim and Sib Sibanda turn their attention to the subject of hope. They interrogate the modern concept of YOLO, you only live once, which focuses on the individual, the moment, and putting personal happiness at the center of our decision-making process. Then an interesting allegory of four guys peeling vegetables in prison pops up to provide a picture of what it might mean to live with eternity in mind.
Welcome to Reframed. Join us as we explore the concept of redemptive business in our unique context on the African continent.
Hello and welcome to the third mini-series in our Monday Christian podcast. In the first one, we discussed the importance of perspective in engaging redemptively in business. In the second, we explored the biblical Christian worldview on business through the perspective of love, love for God, love for others, and for the natural world. And in this mini-series, which spans episodes 10 to 12, we'll pretty much do the same thing as we did in the second, but through the perspective of hope. Paul, in many ways, the theme of hope is a natural progression from our previous episode, which we ended off, if you remember, by pondering the mysteries of Christ's second coming and how his promise to make all things new and restore perfect love should impact the way we do business as Christians. It is, after all, the fact of his resurrection and the certainty of his return that are the basis of Christian hope. But here's the rub, Paul. This idea of Christian hope, of something that we are waiting for, flies in the face of that most basic of human instincts to gratify one's desires here and now, doesn't it?
Yeah, it 100% does. And if we take a recent cultural phenomenon like YOLO, you only live once, as a way of comparing that with the Christian hope of Christ's second return, we can tease out some of these differences. YOLO is actually quite interesting to break down because I think it symbolizes what where Western society is today. It's individual focused. It is about the moment, about the now. It is about putting happiness at the center of your decision-making process. And it's about kind of maximizing the pleasure before you die because there's nothing that exists beyond death.
Right.
And a slightly darker side to this is if there's nothing beyond death, then there's no real accountability for your actions. So what does it matter? And now I'm obviously taking it to its full extent and no one actually lives this way. But if you contrast this to the Christian worldview that, and we're going to go into a little bit later on, but at the very least that there is eternity, even from as early as Genesis 1 and 2, we see this. I just want to draw your attention to the two trees that is mentioned in the Garden of Eden. The first, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and the second, the tree of life. And we know the main issues were around the tree of knowledge of good and evil. But the second one implies a couple of things that I don't think many have thought through. So let me just read it first, and then we can dive into some of the implications. Okay. So Genesis 2:22, and the Lord God said, "The man has now become like one of us, knowing good and evil. He must not be allowed to reach out his hand and take also from the tree of life and eat and live forever." So from here, I think you can make two implications. So firstly, we were made to live for eternity. And this was originally enabled through consuming fruit of the tree of life. And clearly there were implications for eating it. Otherwise, it wouldn't matter to God and he wouldn't have told us or he wouldn't have wanted to restrict us.
Right.
Later on in the New Testament, we see other scriptures point to us as Christians having eternal life with Jesus. Using this as a starting point for how we differ from a worldview like YOLO is incredibly important. There is an afterlife, and therefore it affects us today.
Right. Yeah, I just want to just back up a little bit, Paul, and play that tape slowly, because I think there's a lot in what you've just said. And I know we're going to, a bit later on, talk about the presuppositions behind certain ways of thinking. So we're going to get into that, but I just want to interrogate that. So, because there might be Christians listening in thinking, well, I live by YOLO and I think it's great, but there sometimes isn't a critiquing of the underlying presuppositions. The first one, as you pointed out, that YOLO starts with you, right? And it puts you at the center of the narrative, which is contrary to the biblical story, of course, because you're not the center of it, right? Yeah. And then the second one is that idea of once. So this idea that you've got a fixed amount of time, and again, you touched on this, and in that time, you have to suck as much pleasure out of life for yourself because you are the subject. You are the master of the story. And then after that, your time's up. So a bit like those game shows where there's money blowing everywhere and you have to grab as much of it as you can, right?
Exactly,
and
so, right,
and sometimes even as Christians, we get sucked into that way of thinking. And then again, that final presupposition, which you spoke about, of that actually, if there is no eternity, then there's no consequence. So I can pretty much get what I want because life's about me, get as much of it as I want, do what I want to do with it, and then it's over, right? Mm. And so it's quite important to think through that carefully before we as Christians just embrace philosophies like that, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, and I would add to that, there's a reason why it is, to some extent, attractive. Because there's a part of YOLO that I think is true, but we've got to connect the dots in the right way.
Yeah.
It is true that the life that we have pre-death is once.
Yes.
I think it's Hebrews that speaks about, you know, you live once or you die once and then you'll be judged. And there's a preciousness to life. And that part I think YOLO gets, that there's a preciousness to life. But what comes after death really informs what you do with the preciousness of life, right?
Right.
And so that's the clear distinction. So we can't just wholesale swallow YOLO from a Christian perspective. You've got to interrogate what is it pointing to that is actually true.
Yeah.
But what is it pointing to that if combined with that sliver of truth turns it into something horrific?
Very good.
And that's something to consider, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's pick up on that idea of eternity because it's one that we as Christians, it's an idea at least that we as Christians perhaps take for granted. But the reality is that other religions and other worldviews have significantly different views on life after death, don't they?
Yes, it's one of the things that we have to grapple with as humankind is that we need answers to some of the big questions in order to function. And every religion, every worldview has some answers or has answers to these big questions. I recently read a book by an author called N.T. Wright, well-known theologian, and the book is called Surprised by Hope. And the quote really is about different worldview perspectives about the future which affect people's lives today. So here it goes. There is a world of difference between the Muslim who believes that a Palestinian boy killed by Israeli soldiers goes straight to heaven, and the Hindu for whom the rigorous outworking of karma means that one must return in a different body to pursue the next stage of one's destiny. There is a world of difference between the Orthodox Jew who believes that all the righteous will be raised to new individual bodily life in the resurrection, and the Buddhist who hopes after death to disappear like a drop in the ocean, losing one's own identity in the great nameless and formless beyond. And in this short quote that I've pointed at, there's four distinct worldviews which have dramatically different perspectives on how to live your life today. I would start off with that. The next step I would go is to actually just sit down and think about it logically. What are the possible options for a post-death world? From the outset, there either is something after death or there isn't.
Yeah.
That's just binary.
Yeah, it's binary, yeah.
And if there isn't anything after death, you know, nothing else really matters.
Yep.
But if you do say, yes, there is something after death, there's some key questions that you're going to have to answer. Firstly, which aspects of us continue into the afterlife?
Right.
Okay. So is it spiritual? Is it physical? If you say yes to this question of whether there is an existence in the afterlife, you've got some other questions that you need to deal with. So firstly, what happens to you after death, afterlife, whatever you want to phrase it?
Yeah.
Do you continue physically? Is there a continuation of your spirit? Or is there a complete reset? Do we have a continuation in our experiences and our memories? Yes, no. Is eternity cyclical? So if you believe in a more Hinduist worldview, their worldview is that it goes in cycles the whole time. So there's no sense of progress towards anything.
Yeah.
You know, if something bad happens, something good will happen eventually, and then something bad will happen. Mm. There's no real sense.
There's no end point.
There's no end
point. It's not going anywhere.
No, of course not. And so, you know, why bother? Versus if you believe in a history or a progression towards some sort of climax that completely changes your perspective on how you live your life today. And finally, and probably the most importantly, in answering all of those questions and coming up with some sort of answer, you've also got to ask, is there going to be some sort of judgment day? Is there going to be some sort of assessment at the end of your life now where whatever the outcome is, that will continue with, or the effects thereof will continue with into eternity. And that also matters, because if there is an assessment, that you live your life very differently to whether or not. I mean, we always used to ask, is there a test on this, right, at university? And that would, why do you ask that? Because you don't want to bother with studying it if there wasn't a test, right? And it's the same thing. If you believe there is judgment, that really affects the way you live.
And just as you said that, is there a test on this? I chuckled because, firstly, because it resonates so deeply with me. I must have asked that question, many times, throughout my high school and university years. But it also does remind me of, I guess, the reason why perhaps for some people, it's more comforting to think of there being no life after death, because the idea of there being a test is not appealing. Because if you think back to those days, if there wasn't a test, you wouldn't bother with what you were studying, right? You could pretty much live how you wanted. If there was a test, there were implications to that. And for fallen humanity, the idea that there isn't a test means that I have the freedom to do what I want. I'm not going to be accountable to anybody, which again, for us is a far more appealing idea than there being a test. And I guess, if there's going to be a test, it also implies that there's someone who's setting that test, right? And so you have to accept the existence of someone greater who sets the test, that you either pass or fail, which in turn means there are consequences for passing, but also consequences for failure. And when you're trying to live a life with me at the center, these are not exciting things to think about, are they?
No, they aren't. And it's, it must be frightening to people. You speak about a test and then there's someone who sets a test, but not only that, there's a standard. What is the standard of the person who puts a test? You know, if we take our pass rates in South Africa for our subjects, it's 30% or 33%. You know, no one's really going to stress about that. But if the standard is 100%, then you start stressing a little, because 100% is quite high. So yeah, all of those factors, again, really drive our behavior today. And the one thing I want to touch on is this believing what you want about the future because it just doesn't sit well with you. That's completely irrelevant. It's more about establishing what actually is true. Right? And working backwards to that. I may not want to believe in something because it makes me feel whatever I'm feeling. But that doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Correct.
And we have to bend ourselves around the truth and not the other way around.
Right.
Which is what YOLO does.
I mean, going back to that example of the test, whether or not I think there's going to be a test is irrelevant. There either is one or there isn't. And if there is a test and I choose to believe that there isn't one, that doesn't exempt me either from the test or the consequences of failing that test, correct?
You're in for a rude awakening.
Okay, let's get to the heart of the matter here, Paul. What we're pointing towards here is that what you and I believe about eternity has significant implications on how we live here and now. So talk to us a bit about that and relate it, if you would, to our lives as Christian business people.
Yeah, so I've been thinking long and hard about this, and I think it's easier to work through this by using an illustration. And there's an illustration that Tim Keller often uses, and I'm going to elaborate on this. And I'm elaborating on it to tease out or show how different aspects of our hope would affect our life today. So the scenario is as follows. Imagine four individuals who were abducted and forced into manual labor for a period of 6 months. They are locked in to this massive warehouse in separate soundproofed rooms. And while they have basic necessities such as water, food, and sleeping quarters, there's not much else.
Right.
A couple of windows in the roof provides them with some sunlight, but no interaction is allowed between the four. The manual labor that they are forced to carry out is to clean and peel vegetables, very mundane work, that are brought into their rooms every day. The vegetables are brought straight from the farm, have not been inspected nor sorted. In the first 3 days, they are required to process all the vegetables delivered to their room. Someone comes to their room every morning, explains this to them, drops off the latest batch of vegetables. If they don't do it, they're punished.
Right.
But from day four, without being given the necessary explanation, no one rocks up into their room unless vegetables have been cleaned, sorted, and peeled. The amount of vegetables that are brought is directly linked to the number processed.
Okay.
So if you haven't processed anything,
yep.
you don't get any new vegetables.
Got it.
Now we've got four individuals and each has a different context.
Hmm.
One, Peter is given absolutely no information about what is happening.
Okay. So he's just seeing vegetables being carted in and told what to do with them.
And that's
no
it.
Context.
And then from day four, no more contact with anyone.
Okay.
Individual two, Samuel, is told that he will receive R1 for each vegetable that he peels, but is not told when he will go home.
Okay.
So he doesn't know. Same with Peter. He doesn't know when he's going home. But the additional piece of information he has is R1 per vegetable.
So peel. He has some motivation.
Some motivation, some okay. incentive. Individual three, John is told that he will be able to go home in 6 months and that he will receive R10 for each vegetable that he peels.
Okay.
Okay. So bigger reward.
Yeah.
And there's a timeline to when he's going to go home.
Right.
Individual four, Andrew, is visited by the president and is personally told that he will be able to go home in 6 months and that he will receive R100 for each vegetable that he peels when the president returns. He is also told that the vegetables will go towards feeding a number of orphanages in the area that he's from,
mm-hmm.
so from his local area, and is left with some pictures of the children he will feed and their stories, background stories.
Right.
They even played a short video of some of the children thanking him for their food.
Right.
And in closing, the president mentioned that he's available via his mobile phone whenever Andrew needs to contact him.
Wow, big difference.
Big difference, right? Almost the same set of
yep.
circumstances, but different information given to each one about their circumstance.
Right.
And so the question becomes, well, I've got a couple of questions for us to process. What do you think is going to be the lived experience of each individual over time? And here's some more concise questions to ponder. Who do you think is going to be the most diligent in their work?
Yep.
Who do you think will be the most content and driven? Who do you think will wake up every morning with purpose and meaning?
Mm.
And who do you think will have the greatest assurance about the future?
So just to summarize what I'm picking up in the changes between these guys. So they're all sitting peeling vegetables, but gradually what we're seeing is, so a couple of things. So reward in the present, then there's an increase in that reward. Then there's also a time. So that sets a limit for when this is going to be over and potentially when I can spend that money. But then there's also a promise of what happens afterwards as well. So there's a gradual increase in those aspects.
Yeah, and personal relevance.
Yes, that's
back
right.
Back to Sam.
Purpose.
Back to the orphanage.
Yes.
A relationship, a president asking him to do this.
Right.
All of those components are, I think, very important to consider.
Okay.
So let's explore each one's perspective. Peter, disoriented, frustrated. He starts peeling the vegetables out of a fear of punishment. Remember, he was punished previously if he didn't do anything.
So Peter has no information about
what's going on. No information after day four, after day three. As soon as the visits stop, he realizes that the punishment is not forthcoming, so he stops peeling the vegetables. What's the point? He soon realizes that it's better to stop peeling the vegetables, otherwise he doesn't get a fresh supply. Rotten vegetables will create a stench.
Yep.
But I think after a while, he stops again. There is no perceivable end to this madness.
Yes.
And he gets used to the stench.
Yes.
So why bother?
Yep.
That would be, I suspect, Peter's experience. Mm. Samuel is also disoriented, but less so because he received some information about what's going on. So remember, he got told it's R1 per vegetable.
Correct.
It's not much, but it's something. And he starts putting in the work to process the vegetables. He works hard and has been soon amassed a decent amount of money. However, he soon realizes it's all kind of pointless, all this money and nothing he can do with it. Because remember, he isn't told when he's going to go home.
Yeah.
He also ends up giving up and is in the same place as Peter.
Right.
John does the sums. He realizes he can earn some big bucks there.
And he knows when he's going home.
And he knows when he's exactly. So he can plan for that, right? He processes vegetables steadily and quickly, and he soon sits with a significant amount of cash. At some point, he slows down because he has enough.
Yeah.
You know, he only had certain aspirations for the money, and he's run out of it. He can buy his Ferrari as soon as he steps out. The vigor is no longer there. He's been fairly sloppy from the start, and the processed vegetables have been skinned inefficiently and full of pock marks. He's not really clear what the point of the vegetables is, but at least he's earning R10 a vegetable.
Right? So he's got no purpose beyond the money that he's getting.
No, there's no care put into work otherwise because they haven't told him it means anything whether he takes care or not. And the last is Andrew. Andrew can't believe that the president has given him this job.
Mm.
We have different views about our president, Africa, but if you respected him, you
would. Sure, the office at least.
Exactly. It must be important. Otherwise, why would the president take his time to give him this instruction? Making sure that the orphans are fed is also giving him a sense of purpose.
Yeah.
He also kicks a log of how much time is left, and as the day nears, he grows in anticipation of the president's second coming, second visit, and being reunited with his family.
Yes.
I mean, he's looking forward to that. He has regular chats with the president and almost feels like they're family. The money he's earning is going to go a long way to buying them a home and going on a holiday that they've been waiting for. And, you know, he keeps a steady pace because he knows that children are being fed. So he's got to make sure that there's a constant supply of well-peeled vegetables to be able to feed the orphans.
Yeah.
And he also wants the president to know that he took his duty seriously.
Yeah.
Hopefully, I illustrated through those four individuals drastically different behaviors based on the information they have about their situation and where they're headed.
Yes.
And I think what's important to note is Christianity gives a multi-dimensional perspective of our hope. And each aspect, each dimension of that hope is critically important because it speaks to a part of our humanity.
Right.
Incentives only address one part of our humanity. A personal relationship only addresses one part of it. Together, they
purpose as well addresses something else.
Exactly. All of that has to be seen together.
I mean, it's quite interesting because listening to that, when you hear Andrew's situation, right? So Andrew being the last guy who is visited by the president, he's been given, 100 rand for each vegetable he peels. He's been given, 6 months to do it. He knows why he's doing it, to feed orphans, etc. It, in the context of that story, it just sounds too good to be true, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And yet the point of it all is that this is an allegory for our relationship with God, or certainly the Christian narrative, isn't it, Paul? Maybe just join the dots for us there before we close.
Yes. And so, I mean, that's exactly right. I would hope people got lost in that illustration, say, wow, that would be so cool if it
was.
That would
be amazing. Yeah. I wish I was him. Yeah.
But I would just go back and say, well, actually, the Christian faith is.
That is you.
That is you. Yeah. You are Andrew.
Yeah.
You have all the information, all the information is in the Bible, but you actually aren't aware of it. And that's the big difference. Mm. And this is why we're doing this mini series is to share some of those multidimensionalities of the hope that is presented in God's word to us. And this, going back to, you always ask, you know, what about business people in today and what's the practical implication? If we knew our businesses continued into eternity, and only that which we do out of love for God and our neighbor will continue into eternity. We discussed it in the previous episode on love. What type of employees are you going to be nurturing? What type of products are you going to be building? What type of investors do you want to attract to invest in your company? And just to allude to future themes, it's not just Christian everything.
Right.
It's not just Christian employees, Christian products, Christian investors.
Yeah.
Common grace is an important theological concept to grapple with as we build businesses in the real world. And so there's a lot to uncover, but all of it comes back to what is our hope of the future?
Yeah.
What do we put our dreams and aspirations on? And it will impact the way we live today.
Yeah, yeah. Just a final thought as we land this is that whole point from the allegory on reward. Often we measure our businesses by the bottom line today, and that's how we measure success. So what's your annual turnover, et cetera, et cetera. But with this perspective, with the biblical perspective, where we know that there is, and we'll talk about rewards later, but there's purpose in what we do here and now, and there's reward to come, means that the way we measure success and the way we define success as Christian business people is multidimensional. Mm. It's not all about the dollars and cents. Is that fair to say?
Yes. It's not an issue of incentives at all. It's about what the incentives are.
Great. Well, thanks, Paul. That's a really helpful illustration. As it happens, it frames the rest of the miniseries quite nicely. In the next episode, we'll dive a bit deeper into the theology of Christian hope as a launchpad to exploring the practical applications for business leaders. We'll catch you next time.
Great. Thanks, Sibs.
Thank you for joining us. This episode of Reframed was brought to you by Ziwani, a community of business leaders who partner together to live out their kingdom calling in the marketplace within Africa. Ziwani is a Mergong initiative. To know more about us, visit our website at ziwani.com. That's ZIWANI.com.